Hello, everyone, and welcome to Tuesday Lunch at the Berkman Center for Internet Society. Thrilled to have you guys all here, or back here, or here for the first time, as the case may be. My name is Colin McClay. I'm the Acting Executive Director of Berkman Center, and thrilled to have you all here. And to have our very special guest, Ariel Hotter, who is joining us all the way from California. He came for the Massachusetts lovely fall weather, which we have dutifully provided him with. But before that, I wanted to ask you if we could be so kind as to go around the room, tell Ariel to whom he is speaking or speaking with. So please to identify yourself in ever so brief ways and to take note that you are being webcast, recorded, and otherwise transmitted into cyberspace and recorded for posterity from here until we run out of web space and server space, and to come back on Tuesdays subsequently, making sure to RSVP. And are there any other such announcements that I'm missing? Okay, so with that, perhaps, tell us who you are.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Wolf Richter, visitor from the Oxford Internet Institute, writing on my thesis on innovation in copyright law.
Hi, I'm Albert. I'm a visiting student at MIT AI Lab. I came from the University of Southampton in England.
I'm Steve Schultz. I'm a fellow here working on the Media Cloud project.
I'm David Lachelle. I'm a developer here working on the Media Cloud project. Just started today.
First day!
Yeah, my name is Dr. Engel. I'm from Germany visiting, and my fields are artificial intelligence and computer programs as teaching aids.
Hi, my name is Lachman. I'm a Berkman Fellow here and also a PhD student at the Edinburgh School for Communication at UPenn.
Hi, my name is Jules Goins. I work for a nonprofit that works with technology and media issues and volunteerism.
Hi, I'm Jordan. I work part-time at the Harvard Medical School. I do web design and public.
Dan Jones, Berkman staff.
Amar Asher, Berkman staff.
John Zhixiao, Business Scholar of Blair Benson for Chinese Studies.
Chris Babbitts, I'm a clinical fellow at the Cyber Law Clinic here at Berkman.
Corina Di Gennaro, I'm a Berkman fellow working on internet and democracy.
I'm Ben Sheldon, I'm with the CTC Vista project that Jules just introduced, and we're based at UMass Boston.
I'm Ian Lamont, I'm the managing editor of the Industry Standard.
Aaron Shaw, I'm a Berkman Fellow and a PhD student in sociology at UC Berkeley.
John Clippinger, Berkman Fellow and Director of Law Lab.
Gene Koo, Berkman Fellow.
James Kerwin, Assistant Director of the Program on Negotiation here at the Law School.
Sarah Cortez, IT Consultant.
Chris Segoyan, Student Fellow at Berkman.
Marina Simon, Software Developer.
Joris van Hoboek, a PhD candidate in law, visiting researcher from the Netherlands.
Kevin Bracey, Berkman staff.
Jonathan Zittrin, Berkman teacher, and lucky beneficiary of three to LA hosted by Ariel, which involved, I felt like I was on Entourage, playing Turtle specifically.
To be sure, that's not why we've invited him.
And you're all on the show.
Hey,
I actually didn't even realize he was coming, so yeah, no. Not.
My name is Roxy Myram. I'm new to the Berkman Center and just started as a research assistant on the cooperation research project.
Welcome.
I'm Esther Hargitay. I'm a fellow and on the faculty in the Communication Studies Department at Northwestern.
I'm Jason Kaufman. I'm a Berkman Fellow. I'm a sociologist and I'm studying social networks using Facebook.com data.
I'm Victoria Stoughton. I'm a Berkman Fellow on Internet and Democracy.
I'm Melanie Dulon. I'm a Berkman Fellow working on Copyright for Librarians.
I'm Harry Lewis. I'm a computer science professor here at Harvard and a Berkman Fellow.
So before we begin, I want to make one other announcement, which is to remind you folks, that, especially that side of the room, that these things sound like moderately sized jet engines. So when you speak, make sure to speak up so that Ariel and the folks at this end of the room can hear you. And next, so as noted, we, through Jonathan's interactions with Ariel and Hollywood Hill, had the great good fortune to meet about in March of this year.
We actually...
We.
Oh, we, yes, yes. Yes, yeah, when Colin was out in L.A., we did for that conference. Yeah.
And so he put on, Ariel's work at Hollywood Hell brings together a really unique group of folks that you have in Hollywood, the creators, the industry, but also the technologists and others who are interested in social change, really in creative ways, I think, trying to harness the unique resources of that area and the interests in bringing about something so modest as global change. So we naturally, immediately, in conversations with Ariel, Catherine and I were totally taken with the ambitious and slightly crazy goals, but also with the fabulous resources and the really creative approach to bringing these different elements of the community together in novel ways. And I think I'm going to not try to describe any further, because I'll just seriously put my foot in my mouth, other than to say I look forward to hearing some of these great ideas and to you guys all diving in and helping Ariel to refine them and make them even better in the way that only this odd and lovely group can. So with that.
Thank you, Colin. Give him a round of applause. He doesn't get it enough. So thank you so much, Colin, Catherine, Jay-Z, for inviting me out here. It's wonderful to be out here. We first came across the Berkman Center in 2004 with the Global Voices Conference and, you know, came out and met a bunch of people, Ethan Zuckerman and Jay-Z, et cetera, and have been impressed ever since and wanting to come up with ways to collaborate on these projects as they've evolved. Just two footnotes. All of this stuff I'm about to show you is off the record, and the webcast will probably get edited as well. So don't have high hopes.
Well, hold on. There's a live webcast, so if you want...
Afterwards. For those that want to watch it right now, but I mean the archive. Yeah.
Is that a click-through non-agreement?
I'm just... It's a verbal agreement. Our attorneys are watching the webcast and transcribing right now. So I'm just going to try and run through this. There's a lot of stuff I'd like to say. I'm very excited. You're a very diverse group. I didn't expect it to be this diverse, so it should make the conversation even more interesting, and I'll take off my jacket and get a little bit more informal. So I used to be in the internet at CMGI back here in Andover during the internet boom, which was a large venture capital firm investing in hundreds of startups. When the internet tanked, I went out to Hollywood to get into the film industry, and I ended up landing at United Talent Agency, which is basically, you know, like Jerry Maguire, the movie. And I was there for several years, you know, representing writers, directors, producers in film, and then ended up getting hit by a car and decided to change my life and go into the nonprofit sector and just do something more constructive with my time. I ended up partnering up with another colleague who's a tech specialist. He's now over at DreamWorks Animation. His name's Ori Neidich. And he was also a digital domain before that, which is Hollywood's largest special effects studio. And him and I ended up partnering up with a third person, Paris, who is former CFO type from KPMG on Wall Street. And we set out to create a new social activism organization for Hollywood. What we had come to realize was that at this point, social activism in Hollywood has really boiled down to just writing checks. It's all about fundraising at this point. There's no more people marching down the streets like they did in the 70s and 80s and 60s. And at the same time, Hollywood as a town has actually tons and tons of resources that are going untapped. And as we move into this next century, it was time for a new nonprofit in Hollywood that could basically bring together all of the professionals and tap into their skill sets and their talents much more efficiently and effectively than has been done in the past, and go beyond just check writing. You've got a world-class business community of everything from agents to managers to attorneys to producers, studio execs, network execs, and they barely do anything with regards to social activism. On the creative side, we've got the largest creative community in the entire world, obviously, in film, television, and music. And if you counted the amount of PSAs and, you know, short-form content coming out of Hollywood every year, I mean, it's really, like, you know, minimal compared to how many thousands of professionals could do more. So we looked at that, and then there's the third component that Hollywood has that very few other towns have, which is the ability to get our phone calls returned. There's that sexy component that we have. You know, you could say Wall Street has it a little bit, Silicon Valley, Charlie. And it's an incredibly important element for social activism because, frankly, if you can't get in the door, if you can't get your phone calls returned, you can't change the world. It's just that simple. And so we looked at combining, you know, this ability to basically have everybody in the world on our Rolodex to get through any door we need to get through, as well as the largest creative community in the world and a world-class business community comparable to Silicon Valley and Wall Street. And it became an issue of how do we then pull together all of these people and tap into their skills and talents. Well, the thing that's changed over the last 15 years is we've got communication technology. So suddenly, for the first time really in Hollywood, you've got the ability to communicate with tens of thousands of professionals in 3 minutes by email and have them respond back to you in 3 minutes by email. And I know it's a really simple concept, but like it is with everything, it's all in the details. And the reality is that, you know, in 1984, when Barbara Streisand and Jane Fonda were marching down Wilshire Boulevard for, you know, Roe versus Wade causes, they didn't have email. I mean, they were on snail mail and phone calls. You know, they wanted to throw together a rally. They had to call everybody. If they wanted to create an event, they had to schedule it 4 months in advance and send out a hard copy invite. And when you're talking about organizing people and, you know, communicating with them and mobilizing them, the paradigm has completely shifted in the last 10 to 15 years. And things like MoveOn.org have come along and shown us that, you know, you can actually, you know, scale up now to like 8 million people you're communicating with in a matter of minutes. Well, the same model is now being brought into Hollywood with regards to organizing, mobilizing, you know, communicating with the Hollywood community. And the Hollywood community itself is incredibly powerful, obviously. You know, you're talking about top directors, top writers, top actors, as well as business professionals who actually run the town. And all of these people have humongous egos, and, you know, they're very ambitious, and it's just the reality of it. And they've got a global Rolodex. And so you take 10,000 of them and you put them under one roof. That's a very, very powerful organization. And that's exactly what we have done, is basically create a membership organization called the Hollywood Hill, where for the first time, we're getting everybody on the grid. We're now, you know, as a membership organization, bringing in this diverse group of business and creative professionals under one roof. And then we are educating them on everything that's going on around the world with regards to innovations in science and technology that, you know, are presenting solutions to social problems, everything from global warming to healthcare to education. So we have a tremendous amount of educational programming, which, of course, has always been a weak point of Hollywood. I mean, we're all regarded as flakes, right? You know, whether it's Paris Hilton or whoever, I mean, and you guys probably look at Hollywood and say, yeah, I mean, they're very flaky. I mean, that's what you would assume. And so one of our main goals was to, you know, make Hollywood creatives, including the actors, really, you know, get them up to speed on all of these issues so that when they're walking down the red carpet, you know, like Maggie Gyllenhaal did, you know, a year ago on the World Trade Center premiere, you know, they're not spouting stupid rhetorical things out that they're going to get crucified for. So, as well as we want to go way beyond that and put them to work actually on projects.
Do you want to edit that out? Or
exactly. We'll be editing that. No, actually, I don't need to edit it. Yeah, you see, I'm forgetting that I'm being videotaped.
She knows what
she said. That was not part of the deal. We built this thing called the Hollywood Hill. We launched it 24 months ago. It's now one of the largest, you know, membership organizations in Hollywood. And we're getting, you know, we're growing towards that 10,000 mark, which at that point is tremendous. It has its own revenue model, you know, membership fees. It's very simple, but it's very effective, to be honest. And it allows us to not have to do an annual fundraiser in Hollywood, which there's millions of, as you can imagine. We don't have to engage in fundraising at all. Okay, so that was our first thing. Then we were like, how are we going to put all of these Hollywood professionals to work on projects? Well, we realized we can, for the first time in history, also create web-based project management software. You know, some of you guys probably use, what's that one, Basecamp, or some of those, you know, really effective online project management softwares. And so we can have our people, no matter if they're, you know, on location filming something in Germany or they're, you know, at the home base in LA, they can all sign in together and communicate with their team members using video conferencing, email, you know, text messaging through project management software. And it doesn't, that allows them to integrate for the first time project work into their lives absolutely seamlessly, where they can come to a centralized location when they're free and they can communicate with team members. Now, the third thing we wanted to do was projects, obviously. We want to do hundreds and hundreds of projects. Now, we need a way to finance projects. We need to be able to distribute content that we create. And there's this last component. We want to engage the public. we've been watching the marketplace over the last, you know, several years, and we've seen the scalability issue again come back in a really big way. And the reference I make, I'm sure, how many of you have seen the Did You Know video? None of you. Okay, great. Well, I'm not going to play it for you, but even though it is effective, but Jay-Z would probably kill me. But it's MySpace at this point is about the 10th largest country in the world, if you take how many members it has. Google Earth has 200 million people worldwide have downloaded Google Earth. How many of you have downloaded Google Earth? Okay, a sizable amount. Okay, you're a part of that Google Earth community. Well, you guys are the 5th largest country in the world. You're 2/3 the size of the US. This is what's happening as we move forward into the next decade, is online communities are being created of a scale that have never before existed in human, you know, history. And at this point, the holy grail of social change, through our viewpoint, is who is going to create that kind of scalable, you know, website community that is actually under a nonprofit umbrella. Right? Because Google Earth is not a nonprofit, MySpace is not a nonprofit. What if, though, Google Earth and MySpace were nonprofits? You'd have the 5th largest country in the world as a nonprofit. And suddenly, when it sends out action items, just like MoveOn does, of email, phone, fax, or senator, you've got a country the size of Brazil emailing, phoning, faxing your senator. I mean, it's tremendous power, not to mention all the other things. If you asked everybody to chip in a buck, on Saturday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you'd have $200 million if everybody pitched in. That's a hell of a lot of money. Even in small fractions, it's a lot of money. So we started looking at that. We started looking at microfinance models. How many of you guys have seen Kiva.org? Yeah, quite a few of you. Okay, so Kiva.org, but you know, how can you get down into like even dollar contributions? You know, when you've got 200 million people, like $1 per person is plenty. You know, so you get closer to being able to do much smaller contributions on that side. Obviously, websites present a way for us to distribute content as TV and film move online. So to make a very long story short, we realized that we could solve our issue of financing projects, delivering content, and engaging the public through a website. And that we could create a website, a very sophisticated website, that could accomplish all these things for us and finish basically our machine through which we want to change the world. So we've called this thing Armchair Revolutionary, and it launches in about 2 or 3 weeks. And I'm going to give you guys a preview. Now, no one has seen this except a small handful of our members. So I'm going to run through some of these are live, you know, things, and I'll give you a quick demo, and then we'll go through the business models, and then we'll take questions. Every day you're going to come to a website, you're going to sign in, and this is your personal page, okay? And what it's got is 3 task items that we're asking you to do. It's got all of the points that you've been earning by doing these task items, etc. It's almost like a game. We've got a news feed here where we track all of the innovations in science and technology around the world, and we update you on them. We also turn that into a news video. And then below all of this is all of the projects that you're involved in and some simple metrics. So, you know, how many downloads have been done on it, how many emails sent, how many phone calls. These are just simple things. And this is version 1.0. So as we move to version 2.0, et cetera, these will become more sophisticated. You'll have charts. You'll have, you know, all kinds of stuff. So as you work your way through this every day, you've got several options. For instance, you can do these 3. You just press do it now, or you can show me later, and it'll go back into a queue, and a new one will load down. Or you can, there's a button here, show 3 more, and it'll cycle through, just like a slot machine. 3 more tasks. Now, the idea behind this was that we wanted to do hundreds of projects. Well, how do you finance hundreds of projects? Well, the only real way, if you want to do it in a community-based way, is you get a usership of at least 1 million, you know, to 10 million users, and then you launch, you know, hundreds of projects, you divvy them up into specific task items, and then you deliver those task items to the community every day, and they do it, you know, as a massive undertaking. And that's the model here. Now, every day, every weekday, we plan on launching a new project. It's very ambitious. And we'll be, each project will have about 10 task items associated with it that over the course of several months, we'll ask the public to be doing. And the task items, there's about six core functionalities, technologies that we're integrating into the website to allow people to do. One of which is obvious donations, you know, purchases. So in this case, we want to create a documentary on Dongtan, which is a carbon neutral city outside Shanghai that's being built by the Chinese government. They've hired a top, you know, engineering firm, Arup, to come in and literally design and build a carbon neutral city from scratch on an island. Now, there's nobody documenting any of this on, you know, video, and they're coming up with a lot of really interesting innovations. So we thought, why don't we send over like a director like Ridley Scott to shoot this thing, but not for theatrical distribution like in Communion Truth, but instead as a how-to video for, you know, urban green design. And then we could burn it to DVD, and we could ship it to every major architectural firm and construction firm in the world and get it into the hands of the people that are actually doing urban design. So it's very strategic. It's very highly targeted. We're getting it to the people that need to know it. So in this case, we're asking you to donate 99 cents. And there's a cap. Every donation we ever do will be only 99 cents. You can't give more. If you want to give more, we suggest you go and you recruit your friends to come in, create an account, and for them to give. So that's a donation. I'll show you how that works in a sec. Download Screensaver. How many of you guys know this SETI project? Okay, half of you. Okay, distributed computing has tremendous power and potential. However, believe it or not, only about 1 million people, you know, have downloaded the Boeing software, which allows you to connect personal computers, create a virtual supercomputer, and then crunch huge mathematical equations, et cetera, for researchers at, you know, universities, et cetera, when they're working on solving everything from diabetes to cancer. So we want you to just download this Screensaver software that would allow us to tap into your PC, and when it's sleeping, it will connect to a server at Stanford or wherever, and or Harvard, and download, you know, some bits of information to crunch and send it back to that university. That's a free thing, so it's a download. Here's another example. We are integrating VoIP conference call technology so that when you sign up with an account for us, we already have, obviously, your mobile number or all of your phone numbers. Now, here's a project, an example, biodegradable mobile phone. Why doesn't one exist in the world today? You know, 500 mobile phones are bought in China every year alone. So here's where we wanted to create a biodegradable mobile phone, and we've come up with a variety of task items. This one's just an example. We want you to call Motorola's head of plastics, okay? And we want you to, essentially what you're gonna do, and I'll show you how this would work, is, let's find the right, okay. You press do it now, and a prompt is gonna come up. And it's gonna have a transcript, a few sentences that we want you to recite. Hi, I'm Joe Schmo. I'm working on the Armchair Revolutionary Project to create a biodegradable cell phone. And we wanted to introduce you to this new plastic that's been invented by this, you know, university professor in the UK, and email you a cost-benefit analysis PDF, you know, on the advantages your company would have if you started using this. You could do the same for a manufacturing firm in China. 2 seconds. And so you will read that transcript. When you're ready, you'll press this button, which will actually say initiate the call, and it will call your cell phone, and it'll call this guy's phone number at Motorola, and we'll connect you instantaneously on a voice conference call for free. And we obviously preload the Motorola phone number and have yours. Yeah.
How does that model denial service, both in terms of overburdening their voice system and also flooding their inbox with PDF files?
Well, first of all, you're making the assumption that we're having 1 million people do it all at the same time, which we're not. Like, we would look at and say, maybe we want 5 people to do this, or 10, or 1, right? So we would limit it. The point is, we're not necessarily saying, like, we're going to have everybody do this one tax action item. We might just have one person do it, right? So it brings up a very interesting point, which is the strategy behind these task items and the idea of crowdsourcing on such a level. And the fact is that we've looked at this in a kind of MBA way, that you can look at biodegradable cell phones and say, why doesn't one exist? You know, and you've got 3 market sectors. You've got, you know, the manufacturers in China, you've got the designers like Motorola, and you've got the consumers that buy the phones. Now, how do you go into each marketplace and identify the pressure points you need to push in order for adoption to take place or whatever? So in the consumer market, we might go over, and on Armchair, one of those task items might be, we want you to put $50 into an escrow account with us and purchase a future biodegradable cell phone. And when we get 100,000 people into that bulk order, we will then walk over in a very public way and, you know, have a press conference in front of Motorola and say, we've got 100,000 people that have purchased a biodegradable cell phone, which clearly shows there's consumer demand. Are you going to fill this order or are you not? At the same time, we could go over to, you know, these manufacturers in China. We can go through our database of users, see who speaks Chinese, and we can send them a specific task item to call this manufacturer in China, introduce them to the cost-benefit analysis. You could do for Motorola a million different things. So the idea is to use these task items highly strategically and identify, you know, in the marketplace in real time what these pressure points are, come up with task items, feed them through, and we're calling it basically marketplace acupuncture.
Okay, we shouldn't get too snagged on this, but I'm with Chris. I mean, you know, you've just given a five-minute explanation of something that sets off alarms here.
Like, sure.
There is no way I'm giving you my telephone number if I know that this is what you might do with it. Right?
Well, you're initiating the call.
What? No. But you've got my phone number now.
Sure.
If you ever want to put pressure on me.
In all honesty, it wouldn't be that hard for us to get almost anybody's phone number.
But I understand. Well, if that's the philosophy that you
that's a very good point. It's a very interesting point.
We're all exposed anyway, and we're going to show you how to put pressure.
Yeah,
on
yeah. Okay. Remember, we're not calling the personal phone number of the Motorola guy. We're calling his office number, which is entirely different. Obviously, we're not going to call anybody's personal cell phone number and, you know, harass them personally.
Anyway, you're going to have to persuade people that you're using this not only strategically, but judiciously.
Well, it is that issue that we're riding a very fine line between, you know, pushing the marketplace in directions versus harassing, you know, the marketplace. But the reality is, when you're working in the nonprofit world and with social change projects, it's always a carrot and stick routine if you're trying to actually affect change. You've got to go to, if you're dealing with corporations, it's going to be a carrot and stick routine. And you've got to beat them over the head a little bit, but you've also got to give them a way out. And you've got to do it just with delicacy. And that's what we'll be facing, absolutely. So just to finish up, I will say just a few points. There's other technologies we're building in, some sophisticated email technology, et cetera, et cetera. The gaming part of this is very important to us because, particularly with the younger generation, making this fun. At the end of the day, one of the biggest issues to this making this a success is having stickiness, right? In order to have people coming back day after day after day to engage on task items, et cetera, what's the reason for coming back? And coming from Hollywood, I can easily answer that question. It's going to be original content, primarily. Do you have lots of video content or text content that's new every day, thus they should return? And that's why these pieces, as well as these pieces, are very important. Everything will be refreshed on a daily basis. Everything will be new. And that is what we've actually got, five quadrants of information that bring you back every day. We've got a video news show, you know, this focus on innovations. And the game, you know, gives you, it's a lot of fun because these numbers actually change in real time. They don't change when you refresh the page. So there will be, for each project, a project details page with that specific project's timeline, the milestones. It'll have the numbers changing in real time because this is all the users contributing, you know, and all the task items being completed in real time. And it makes it pretty exciting, you know? It's like those cigarette billboards that you see that all, you know, people are dying. except it's a lot more exciting. Oh, right.
Could be you.
Could be you, you never know. Maybe that's the project. You're gonna have an activity stream with the users and, you know, in real time, what everybody's doing. So there'll be this constant feeling of activity. You'll have the project details, photos, videos, all of the task items associated with them. The ones that are not active yet or greenlit will be grayed over. You'll have specific project updates, et cetera.
Is there an answer on that page?
There is. It's a very interesting point. And one that I'm sure you'll rip me about. So every project page will have a sponsorship ad at the top, you know, And we don't need to get that much money for those. But we were looking at how do we integrate ad revenues into this site. And so, you know, we decided to put a sliver up there. And it wouldn't be advertisement, it would be corporate, it would be basically sponsorship. Keep in mind that, on his point, there's a lot of projects you can do in the world that would not be going up against major corporations. You know, it's not like we're going out there to get, we're not, our first project is not to go up against ExxonMobil and, you know, get them to, you know, take on green energy technology. There's a tremendous amount of things you can do with this model that, yeah.
Where did the idea start? Who comes up with the first?
Okay, so the structure is we're putting together an advisory board with about 600 people globally that are specialists in every topic. We've got an internal staff that reviews the project submissions. We will take project submissions from the public. That's going live in a week. We also have a team inside that comes up with crazy ideas. I can mention a few and that are out of the box. And those basically get bumped up through a series of phases of review, at which point they go to the, you know, larger advisory board who are specialists. They take a look at, like, you know, the more narrowed down list, and then we flush out those final selections, and those go up on the website. But yeah, it's basically staff.
So if I have a great idea,
yeah,
do I submit it to you, or can I put it up in a public place?
You need to submit it through the website. It would not be public.
Okay.
The reason being, a lot of these things, for instance, two students at the University of Singapore invented a technology for a waterless washing machine 5 years ago, right? They needed $500,000 to build a prototype of this. Now imagine, a waterless washing machine doesn't use water, it doesn't use detergents, and it uses less electricity and does not require a dryer. So right off the bat, you're killing half an industry. You're also going to have a tremendous environmental, positive environmental impact if this thing were actually to be widespread. Now, we would come in, they won first place at an industrial design competition in Europe, but we would come in and say, and they won $100,000, so they still need $400,000. So we would come in and say, okay, $400,000, we're going to finance this thing, build the prototype. Now, in that case, you're dealing with patents, right? Because it's a technology, they're developing, they're going to own the patent. We would come in and say, okay, well, if our users are going to contribute to, you know, this prototype, we want to own part of the patent as armchair revolutionary. We would take, you know, a minority stake in it. Should that product ever make it to the marketplace and develop a profit, that money would go into basically, again, an endowment fund for future projects. None of it's going to be siphoned off to owners if this is not a for-profit venture. However, Armchair Revolutionary is a for-profit structure in the traditional corporate sense, because that way we don't have to deal with any limitations from the IRS, et cetera. So it's very similar to Google.org's model.
So if there are those of us,
yeah,
who would like patents to be open and not know that the viral nature of something often depends on having no patent in the government.
Yeah.
And can that be a term going in, saying, okay, that's a great idea, but and it's patentable, I wish to establish prior art with your help with this, but I'm not interested in having it owned in the traditional sense.
Yeah. Well, if you're the person submitting the project, you're, yeah, saying, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, our dream would be that nobody owns these patents. But the reality of it is most people developing them want to own them.
Yeah.
It might be a product that, you know, would benefit humanity greatly, but the inventors still want to, you know, make some money off of it, in which case we're along for the ride as the public, basically. And all we want to do, in that case, what's going to happen is that if we invest in these patents, et cetera, these technologies, our lawyers are coming, are drafting contracts that would stipulate that any acquisition of that patent or any company that would be formed out of it has to adhere to certain principles. In other words, you know, a Maytag cannot come in and buy this, and, you know, this technology, and then put it in the basement for 100 years, and it'll never see the light of day. You know, we would come up with contracts that would stipulate, you know, you can't do that. And that's tough, but it's doable.
So maybe David can speak to this, but
yeah,
one of the things that the Knight News Challenge folks are doing is they have this digital garage. Is that what it's called? Digital
News Challenge Garage.
So that you have the option of either posting your proposal publicly so,
yeah,
that other people can comment on it and improve
yeah,
it,
yeah,
or you can do it privately.
Yeah.
So you might want to have two streams where,
yeah,
you say one
idea
of them is a way that engages the community in a meaningful way, helps,
yeah,
them brainstorm and push the project up and refine,
yeah,
it so you get a better project, lightens the workload for you,
yeah,
and also gets the idea out there. Or give the option
still,
of saying,
yeah,
well, you still have to work on it, but maybe,
yeah,
you have to work on it less.
Yeah.
Or you have the other private option for folks who, for whatever reason, need to keep it more secret.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, you could do a duo submission, half public, half not. The only problem, I mean, there's several problems I can envision, one of which would naturally occur, which is that the selections are going to be scrutinized clearly by the public of like, why did you do not, or, you know, go forward with this or not? And they're not going to see the non-public submission. So they're not going to see what this is competing against. And that would be an inherent problem of doing that. But obviously we're completely all for transparency. The reality is most people's projects, they don't want them made public, you know, yet because they don't have the funding. You know, the very reason they're coming to us is because they're trying to, you know, keep ownership over something in some way. To give you an idea just quickly of the crazy kinds of ideas so you can realize how crazy we are, massive multiplayer video games that affect real-world consequences. We're in talks right now. We're going to be setting up a center in LA with another top university, a Games for Change Center. And what it is going to do is build about 20 video games for us a year that we're going to launch on Armchair Revolutionary. And it's going to be a very, very cutting-edge, out-of-the-box place that we're going to play. How many of you guys know about Games for Change? Okay, Games for Change are games that have positive consequences for society. Either they're educational, or they, you know, have some extra component that your results and your activities in the game are mirrored in the real world. So I'll give you an example. Say we wanted to go into an African country, and this is a cocktail napkin example. Don't take it too seriously. But say we wanted to go into an African country that has an outbreak of disease, and we need to apply vaccines to villagers. What if we went over to Google Maps and we grab all the satellite imagery of that country, and we plug it into a massive multiplayer video game platform? And so you've got a virtual African landscape. Then you go on the ground, and you partner with an NGO, and basically you hand out to villagers Armstrong bracelets that have been modified. They have GPS trackers in them, and they're made out of LED plastic, so they glow when an electrical current goes through them. Okay, everybody follow me? They hand out these bracelets to villagers that have this disease. With those GPS embedded, we can get their real-time location, and we can plug that into this video game and give those people an avatar just like they would have in Second Life. Suddenly, you've got a virtual African landscape, and you've got the villagers in real-time walking around as avatars. You can right-click on their shoulder, and their bio will come down, or their headshot will appear, or anything. And we launched this video game, but instead of Vice City, where you get a gun, you get a syringe, and instead of bullets, you get vaccination shots. And the challenge of the game is to run around and compete against all these other people that are playing the game online against, you know, around the world. And you have to run into these villages, find these villagers, and inoculate them in the shoulder. Now, there's one catch to this game. For every shot that you purchase, you basically have to purchase every shot for 50 cents in US dollars. And when you inoculate that individual, we know who it is, because obviously they're a real person when we're tracking them. And that inoculation, the money that you paid for it, the 50 cents, gets wired to that NGO on the ground. They then send out an electrical signal in the village, which makes that person's bracelet glow, because remember that it's made out of LED plastic. They know when that happens. They're supposed to report to the medvac unit and get vaccinated. And then our Hollywood organization would obviously create a gigantic red-like campaign, you know, Bono's campaign, globally, to promote this game, at which point you'd have millions of people signing on instantaneously and playing each other and inoculating entire villages. One of the biggest hurdles of that, obviously, is just keeping up with the virtual space on the ground. You know, but you could technically, you know, theoretically, you could walk through countries in a matter of hours and inoculate them, yeah.
I guess one of the other challenges is that
making it fun.
Absolutely. Well,
I guess for me, running around and injecting people with syringes, I hate needles, so maybe that's why. But but I mean, if you have to run around, I mean, you wouldn't be the first video game company to have this idea of you got to pay 50 cents an hour to play. But you're charging 50 cents per bullet here, and that seems like it's a lot.
It's not at all, because you're saving somebody's life, literally.
The graphics are really good.
Okay. You're saving somebody's life. I mean, imagine the commercial for this game on TV would be the kid sitting in front of his computer at, you know, 5:30 at night, and his mother's calling him, you know, into the dinner table, and she's like, you know, get in here, blah, blah, blah. And the kid's like, just one more minute, Mom. I've got three more lives to save. I mean, literally. Seriously. I mean, is there anything more, you know, intoxicating than actually saving lives in real time just by clicking on a mouse? Literally? I mean, we can give you the name of the person who you just saved.
Right, so now you're making him give up his legal...
That's exactly the point, is he can connect. Okay. He can connect. Oh, this is like iTunes. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Is the cost of the bracelet more than the cost of the...
Yeah, but they're reusable. They turn it in when they're done.
Why doesn't the bracelet have the medicine in it?
I knew you guys would love this. Why?
And why would they turn it in instead of throwing it away?
By selling it.
I love it. So the point of this example was that Games for Change, which literally started just a couple of years ago, it's a totally new space. There's a group in New York that is pioneering it called Games for Change. You can look them up online. There's several universities, Parsons, USC, et cetera, around the country that are that have started to work on it in their, you know, gaming departments, which themselves are very new. And we're starting to take the space. It's really primarily focused on educational games. Like, they had a Darfur game, like, a year ago, where you experience what it's role-playing. You experience what it's like to be a Darfur refugee. But, I mean, who's going to, you know, who wants to play that all day? I mean, the problem with those games, although highly educational, is that nobody wants to play them. And they're really not going to change the world. They're just, I mean, you can still, you know, play that game all day long, but it has no real-world consequence. What we want to do is connect the dots between the virtual world and the real world and actually game, you know, create games with integrated technologies like location-based, you know, technology, mobile technology, all of these things that are in the real world, integrate those in the game so that you can actually mirror the you know, your activities in the real world. And that could be a really interesting recipe, yeah.
Within the approval process with the advisory board or that whole group, I mean, how much do you allow for, like, dissenting proposals to be in here? Because, I mean, something like the bracelets, there could also be another proposal with mobile phones. There could be another proposal with, you know, competing NGOs who it's not yet proven who has the most effective model. So is that, would you allow competing proposals on the site to see who has a stronger pitch?
I mean, we're open to, obviously, as many ideas as possible. We're the kind of folks that it's best idea wins. Sometimes it's not going to be apparent what the best idea is, like you're saying. Now, with the games specifically, we're building into the business model of how those things are launched, that they will go out into the marketplace. Before that, they're prototyped, they're sent to the field, they're tested out by people that are on the ground, that are specialists in those areas and with those environments. They come back, they go into production, they're sent out and deployed, at which point we're constantly gathering real-time feedback. We can always tweak the game and polish it, and will be, constantly, to make it better and better and better. These things continue to live on if they're successful. If they're not, they die and we reinvent. Yeah.
I guess within Armchair Revolutionary, though, do you make a choice about, okay, the problem of vaccinating people in this region, we as Armchair Revolutionary have chosen this approach, some other like venture firm or funding group has chosen this approach, and we'll see which one wins, or is it, we're going to embrace all the approaches, they're competing proposals, and whichever one gets funded better is the one that gets funded.
Oh, I see. So putting the choice out to the members. We generally operate under the philosophy that the public, and this goes for also how we operate in Hollywood, doesn't have the time generally to examine all of the necessary research, et cetera, that would allow them to make an educated choice. You know, the point of why they're coming to Armchair, and there's only those three tasks, you know, is because at the end of the day, we're just asking regular people that wake up in the morning and have 5 minutes and they sign in to check the news. We want them to sign in here and check in the three task items, and that's going to be the majority of the public. We'll be lucky if they do the first three. For those that want to go crazy and really love this thing, you can either press the show three more or you can press task. It will take you to the page with all like 40 tasks that are still open that day, and there will be people that are, you know, geeks on this and will, you know, live it day long, absolutely. But we will ask them to make decisions, and we will crowdsource, and we're building an RFP, you know, protocol into it so that we can say, you could start the biodegradable cell phone thing by saying, okay, we're launching a project to create a biodegradable cell phone. Here's the reasons we've examined the marketplace. Here's the reasons we feel it doesn't exist. Now, who has ideas on how we can change that, how we can get one made? And we would put that out as an RFP and say, everybody, members, you know, submit your ideas. You can submit them as a video. You can submit them as text. Google just launched a project thing called 10 to 100 or whatever, where they allow you to submit video proposals. So we would absolutely do that, yeah. And
it sounds like just one of the potential spin-off phenomena from the site might be that people say, whoa, cell phone materials. I didn't know anything about cell phone materials. I've never thought about that before.
Right.
And so there is this educational involved user phenomenon that may happen.
No, absolutely, that's going to happen. And the education part of it is key. I mean, it's also very exciting that in playing this game and coming back every day and being exposed to such a diverse amount of topics and projects and everything, the educational quotient on this is huge. it's really huge, and that's the thing we're feeding off of. Now, just to give you an idea, too, of there's one other thing. Well, yeah, this is something that's really unique, and you'll appreciate it. Particularly, we get approached by a lot of venture capitalists, for instance, who want to have like a first look deal, because we're going to get a lot of submissions on new technologies that need seed funding to do proof of concept, et cetera. So we have a lot of interest from big venture capitalists that would like to become the first investors and have their pick of what they invest in. Essentially, when you look at the financial side of this, it's distributed venture capitalism. I mean, what we're doing is we're turning the public into venture capitalists, and we're distributing it a buck a person. So instead of one VC or one investor giving us $10 million like they would with the X Prize, for instance, and launching a contest, we've got 10 million people giving us $1. And the brilliance of that model, the really exciting things that come with it, low risk to the consumer. None of you would lose any sleep if we lost that 99 cents you just gave us, right? That allows us to go and experiment with that 99 cents in a way that VCs and governments and nonprofits just don't have the toleration for. So we could do a video game like the one I just described and not even think twice about it, because if we lose the 500 grand we assembled for it, it's only 99 cents to every person. So the risk quotient is so low, it allows us to have a very high risk quotient with regards to experimenting with new projects. Yeah.
One, I just think that's a ridiculous concept that, you know, thinking that if you're only taking a little bit for one project from each person, that in that case, there's no responsibility to actually follow through with it. But sort of with that, I guess my question was before you brought that up, but I guess feeds into that, is, you know, I'm thinking maybe for that one project, but over the course of, you know, I may be donating $100 through Armchair Revolutionary. And sort of where is, as you're using this venture capital, somebody is a venture capitalist because they want to get return on investment.
Yeah.
And as a nonprofit, obviously you're getting a social return, social benefits.
Yeah.
So where is the feedback mechanism from you guys in terms of, I've donated this money, where's the evaluation? When am I getting that annual report
yep.
at the end of the year saying this
which
is
key. Yeah, no, that's, I mean, that is a key point. We wanted from day one. The analogy I use is, you know, you sign into your E-Trade account and you've got all of these real-time stock quotes, metrics, analytics, charts, et cetera. We want the same thing. Why shouldn't you have the same thing for your nonprofit, charitable contributions? That is the thinking behind this whole section at the bottom. Is that you're going to have every project that you've donated to, you're going to have this giant grid. And like I said, this is version 1.0. We're going to be developing, each project is very unique. A biodegradable cell phone to a waterless washing machine to a massive multiplayer video game. The metrics you're going to measure those are going to be entirely different, right? And they will include even live video feeds from the web, you know, from the field or whatever, as well as it could be a monetary, it could be, you know, how would you look at a biodegradable cell phone as a project and say, okay, when we reach this milestone, you know, 10 Motorola's have signed on or said they're going to start using this plastic, 3 manufacturers in China. You know, you've got to give a weighting to each one of those things as a progress report. So that's what we'll be doing in this section. Now, when you scroll over these things, these are the milestones, okay? And they will pop up. Like this one signed up 1,000 villagers, right? So you're going to start having, you know, these milestones develop, and they'll all be customized to that project, and it will give you in real time, you know, we're going to have a team of staff at the office that basically upload these, you know, progress reports every day from the field, et cetera, as well as a certain amount of them will be automated because there'll be, you know, tasks that are done through the site. Does that answer your question enough? I mean, do you think that is, you know, enough transparency? It's certainly 10 times more transparency you're going to get with the United Way. So it's a start. It's a start. And from there, we'll innovate. Yeah, Charlie.
Ariel, would you say something more about the legal, corporate, for-profit, non-profit relationship
yeah.
here so that we understand it at a lawyer level?
Yes.
we got a few of those here.
Yeah, so the legal issues inherent in mass crowdsourcing chaos. Yeah. Okay, so this has been a very exciting project from a legal perspective. And everything we're doing, we actually realized that we wanted to do so many things, all these entities. It was too big for one entity because too many mission statements. This has an entirely different mission statement from, for instance, our Hollywood organization. So what we did was, and again, this is off the record, we set up 4 entities. 2 of them are nonprofit structures. One's a 501c3. For instance, that's the one that's doing the Games for Change Center. The other one is a 501c6, which is a trade association nonprofit. That's the membership organization in Hollywood. Over here, we've got Armchair Revolutionary, which is just a S Corp, California Corp. And then we've got the Catalyst Center, which is a giant building in Hollywood that we're taking over and turning into our CENTCOM, basically, that we operate out of. Now, all of these have certain relationships to each other, and those are defined by, obviously, the legal laws. But this is being seen. There's a new movement now to create hybrid structures that are a combination of for-profit nonprofits. A lot of the drive to do that is because nonprofits need additional revenue streams more than just donations, right? I mean, you've got a nonprofit that, you know, there's lots of great examples out there. One is, like, there was a nonprofit that manages a bus route, you know, and they were paying a tremendous amount of money, you know, it's like for disabled people, to service their trucks. So they ended up bringing up, you know, bringing in, you know, maintenance people in-house and doing that, and they got so good at servicing these buses that they ended up starting to do it for the bus companies. And it grew into a business, and suddenly this had potential as a revenue stream. So they outsourced that, and it turned into a whole servicing company for buses, and they started making a lot of their operating, you know, income off of that. So suddenly you've got a nonprofit that creates a for-profit, but still wants to retain control over that for-profit. So how do you do that? Well, that gets down to, without giving you too much detail, gets down to different classes of shares, the board structures, et cetera. And there's ways to do that. There's some top attorneys right now that specialize in that. You know, we obviously use them. And they create different classes of shares so that the nonprofit can retain control over the for-profit entity. When it gets into tricky territory is when the for-profit's revenue back to the nonprofit starts to exceed a certain percentage of that nonprofit's general income. And it starts to look like the nonprofit's a for-profit, basically. So you get it's the proportions of the revenue flowing in different directions, but this is what's allowed. Now, with these entities, obviously, you know, we've come up with, and the reason I'm being vague is because we're still formalizing our official language on how this will be presented. But we have all these different structures, and that is, you know, I hope that answers.
But Armchair Revolutionary is a for-profit corporation.
Entity. Yes, it's a for-profit, well, it's not for, what I like to refer to it, it's a not-for-profit entity. So it's a not-for-profit corporation.
What does that mean?
Well, I'll tell you what it means.
501c.
How many of you know who Mohammed Yunus is?
Okay.
Okay, so Mohammed Yunus has this idea of a non-loss corporation. That's what he uses the phrase, non-loss corporation. The idea is basically a corporation that exists to fund itself and employ a certain amount of people, but not to actually make a profit for anybody. And so a credit union would, to some degree, be an example of that. But there's a yogurt company that, you know, I think Grameen just launched, where it's like this organic yogurt, and, you know, it provides enough nutrition for like a kid in Africa for like an entire week. And it's a company that doesn't serve to make a profit, but it employs a tremendous amount of people. So in other words, you know, it doesn't have to have huge profit margins or anything like that. This is basically the same thing. The whole thing will be transparent, our books, et cetera. And in fact, we hope to have that in real time, even on the website. But it's basically a non-loss corporation. Yeah.
Revolutionary won't be tax deductible.
They won't, but they wouldn't be anyways, because at 99 cents, you have to reach like a 250 minimum to even get there. And so maximum, huh?
Are you selling securities?
No, we're not selling securities. And the reason for that, like, we've looked in all of these areas. We wanted to sell securities, right? And hoping down the road that you could even launch an IPO online. And I don't think it's going to be too much to ask down the road. But for instance, like, you could give money as a loan to people. But for instance, Kiva. Why is Kiva not regulated, but MicroPlace is by SEC? The reason is that if you get your investment back with interest, suddenly you're an investment. Kiva doesn't give you interest, right? You give it a buck and you own it to that African entrepreneur or Eastern European entrepreneur, you get the buck back. You don't get interest. If you did, SEC would be involved like they are with MicroPlace. Yeah.
It sounds like what you're describing is a profit with a nonprofit in a partnership. So either a joint venture would be the term I'd suggest, or profit, not-for-profit partnership. But to use the idea of partnership, because partnerships are subject to high fiduciary duties. The other thing is, just because you're a for-profit doesn't mean you can't do charitable activities. The charitable activities of a for-profit are a deductible transaction.
Are what?
So
if you have a if you have a for-profit that does a charitable donation, the charitable donation can be written from its profit statement as a deduction.
Yes. It gets into tricky territory. Here's another thing that you guys should know. It's not widely reported, but every state, if you want to give, say you had a website and you had a nonprofit and you put up, you know, you wanted a to accept donation from the public online, you actually have to go and register in every single U.S. state to take charitable contributions. And a lot of people don't realize that, but the majority of nonprofits operating online, getting donations, they're doing it illegally, actually. So you would have to go and register with every single state. It's a tremendous amount of legal fees because lawyers have to get involved and do it. Now, in this case, with a waterless washing machine, it's not a donation. We don't want it to be a donation because we would have to do that then. Instead, it's basically seen as a contribution. It's not a charitable contribution. It's just a contribution to a corporate entity. And that's basically the legal scenario, is that they would take the word charitable out of it and it just becomes a regular contribution. Yes. But they're not donations in the same in a charitable sense. It gets very murky with the language. You have to be very careful. It's an investment, basically.
Yeah.
And we're getting part of that patent back, remember, if it's like that kind of investment. If it's something else, it's different. Well, it is, essentially. We're getting equity in something. Absolutely. Well, the public would never go for this thing if it wasn't completely transparent at the end of the day. Anyway, so that it has to be, yeah.
Are you going to roll out all those? Because in addition to the given, there's the time and action stuff. Are you going to roll them all out at the same time? And what's the percentage of each behavior that someone could do? Because there might be a nice hook on, oh, we don't give money. Oh, well, we could give money because that'll help have a more higher value added contribution. But not at first, or...
Say it one more time?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Just once you start Task Feed, is it going to include all three, the money giving, the calling someone, and...
Meaning, can you just pick and choose?
Could you pick and choose, or are you going to provide all of those as an option initially?
They're all options. Like, you can choose to do whichever task you want to do. And then the other ones, there's a button on called Show Me Later, or there's this quick, I'm not interested... In which case, it'll delete that task and never show it to you again. Yep.
Sometimes when people try to do good, they do bad.
Yep.
It's controversial. So is there a mechanism besides not endorsing something where people can speak back and say, anti-revolutionary, you should really reconsider this malaria, or whatever, this could be really harmful.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I will say we are still trying to figure out what the best module for that is. Is it a blog with comments? Is it, you know, a wiki? I mean, like, there's a million ways you could do it. What's the most efficient and effective with so much activity? And if you have any ideas, we'd be all ears. Yeah.
I'm wondering about social networking aspects. You don't mention that at all. Will it be a central model where you're, you know, sending out messages and then getting 10,000 people sending messages back? Or will there be networks of the people that are users?
Yeah, there's a friend's, there's a friend's stats here, and that's another component to this game that I skipped over it, forgetting it, but you will basically be able to upload, just like you can on Facebook, your friends, and create a group, and you can track your friend's stats and compete against them, and eventually, I'm sure, we'll probably roll out some kind of team-driven competitive environment, where you can, team up, because the idea of teaming up for some of these things would be highly, you know, very exciting, particularly if they're a video game or something.
Did you have a question? Yeah. Can I just go back to who is participating in this? Because you described as Hollywood Hills initially, and it sounded like one of the things that you were leveraging was just the special connections that people had, that population had, but now it sounds like you're crowdsourcing to just a generic population.
Yep.
So is it both? Is it that you can detect within our system, oh, Steven Spielberg has signed up, that means that he can call like heads of state and we'll get answered, so we'll deploy him on something much more
it's
useful.
It's a great question, So the way we're looking at it is that every one of these projects might have those kinds of underlying needs, meaning we might need a meeting, you know, with someone, you know, whoever, on a high level, and it might be the best way for us is to do it behind the scenes, go to a Spielberg and have him set up that meeting for us instead of crowdsourcing it. So we do, you know, a certain amount of stuff will be outsourced to the Hollywood Hill behind the scenes on a high level, you know, absolutely. And as well as the audience, you know, as far as the audience, obviously this is meant for the public. This is not a Hollywood-centric entity at all.
Gotcha.
And in fact, I would even go so far as to say we're trying over time to not associate any of the Hollywood entity with this. because we don't want to see it be make it seem like it's a Hollywood created thing. That would not bring any positive baggage. We're very aware of the negative baggage Hollywood brings to social change.
Kind of peer reviewing process where, okay, you finish this project and now all your 10,000 users can say, hey, this went really well, this went really badly, or maybe within your own group. I don't know, yeah. What kinds of review would you have?
We absolutely, a major part of this is review. In fact, the Games for Change Center, one of the reasons the university we're working with is so excited about it, they never have the resources to actually follow their games into the marketplace and track the impact. And at the end of the day, this is all about impact. So they're going to be pulling in, you know, several, you know, all of their disciplines at the school, the different, everything from poli-sci to, you know, international relations, whatever, to bring in, you know, grad students, research. And obviously, where I'm here also with an invitation, we'd love to have, you know, as many people working for us as possible. And tracking the impact. This is all about impact. Yeah, and that's going to be an exciting part of it. And we're going to be we're willing to fail, obviously, a lot of the time. Like, that's what this is about. This is about testing. We take the experimental part of the 99 cents, et cetera, very seriously, that we can afford to fail, and that serves a humongous, you know, opportunity in the marketplace because others cannot afford to do that as much as we can, yeah.
I'm just wondering how many people in a room either are members of the open source community or consider yourselves sympathizers. So I'm wondering for the open source community,
yeah.
Is there an overlap here? Is there any way for cross support? Because
yeah.
a lot of what you're talking about,
yeah.
just as you know, as it does for Harry and some others, raises flags. You know, patents, one company in control.
Yeah.
Well,
you know, we're on the
kind of thing. So
yeah.
I'm wondering what the symbiosis there might be.
Well, the symbiosis is we're in the middle of the capitalistic markets and the open source community, right? And so it's a very bad, you know, comparison, but we sympathize with both, right? And so we're very sympathetic to open source movement, and we see this as a great vehicle for launching and financing, frankly, a lot of open source projects, technology projects. There's, you know, a million that could really benefit from either, you know, any number of things, whether it's actually like crowdsourcing, just getting people involved in coding projects, or it could be financing things. You know, the open source community doesn't have as much of a hierarchical structure. It often has a hard time getting, you know, funding from the top down people. And this is a platform where we can, you know, bring together the public to invest in some of those movements, as well as deploy them, you know, if they were soft. Mm-hmm. We're based, and we needed, you know, a place where millions of people could download this in a very short amount of time, download some kind of open source app. This is another vehicle for that. Now, I should mention also, we are in talks with Yahoo, and we've had a long relationship with them. They're going to probably be giving us a full page on Yahoo, where we will be streaming up, you know, these task items and video content and everything, and tapping into about 4 million of their visitors a month, which right off the bat, if 5% of those people gave us a buck, you're talking about $100,000 per day. Yeah.
I was just wondering how you'll deal with groups that have proposals that have like competing interests. For example, I can see both pro-choice and pro-life people making
yeah.
interesting proposals. Would you just let both groups run their proposals? Or
absolutely
pick
not.
And choose?
No. I mean, you know, this is a subjective exercise, if you want to call it that. I mean, when it comes down to, I mean, you're talking about, a lot of those are policy issues, obviously. There might be technology things that, you know, might be bad or good. We make a decision at the end of the day what we feel is best for society and do it. I mean, this is at the end of the day only one nonprofit entity out of many that are out there. This is supposed to be a complement to the community and an addition, not the, you know, this is not the Empire State Building and nobody else exists. Yeah.
Well, you're targeting not only a very powerful community, but also a community which has, for the past decade, I think, been the very attention of anybody who wanted to do something good
yeah.
or to get their power.
Yeah.
So you're basically competing, or you're playing in a very competitive market already.
Yeah.
So how did you actually come up with, how do you assess the demand that they actually want yet another do something good, like another red movement? How do you interact with your target group? Are they involved in shaping this, or why are you so convinced that you'll succeed first or the others?
It's a great question. So, like, why do we, you know, why do we consider there's demand? I would say we built it for ourselves. At the end of the day, like, we take that approach. That I'm 30 years old. My partner's 31. I mean, when we started this whole initiative, we were 25, which in Hollywood years is, you know, we're children. For instance, like everybody, every Barbra Streisand Jane Fonda that you know is over 60 now. Norman Lear's about 87 years old. He spent $5 million just, you know, just going after the Alito nomination to give you an idea of how much resources he has, okay? The older generation of social activists are now in that, you know, of that age. The younger generation, 20s, 30s, and 40s that's coming up is trying to take over, but it's very hard when the older generation, the Sumner Redstones and Rupert Murdochs, are all in their 70s and 80s. Think about it. I was having a fascinating conversation the other day with somebody about this generational issue, and many of us just don't talk about it, but we really need to, because at this point our society is becoming very crowded with the different generations. And when you move into social activism, you've got all of these generations of people who have been active for years. You've got the newer generations coming up who are much more tech savvy, frankly, rubbing up against the baby boomers and above them, who don't want to deal with technology at all, and who have had decades of social activism experience and, you know, are very set in their ways and feel things need to be done in a certain way. And then you've got the younger people like us that are looking at ways to maximize the new technology revolution and its capabilities. And we looked at what was online and laughed, basically, at how pathetic it is. I mean, we really have no competitor at the moment, which is laughable because we're not doing anything that anyone else could do. We're building this thing for a few thousand bucks, literally. The designer, the coders, all of donating most of their time. All these technologies exist, obviously. What are we doing? We're combining them in a way that hasn't been created before. We're taking MoveOn, putting it on steroids, taking it out of Washington, and putting it in the corporate consumer marketplace, you know, and going after and combining, you know, microfinance with crowdsourcing, with, you know, content, original content, with games, you know, and with real-time project tracking. And it's the assembly of all these things that we feel in this particular way is compelling. You know, it's a recipe, and we think this is what we'd want to play every day, is change the world, you know?
Just a question on origination of content. So you are creating your own content, where the feeds are from different areas and all that.
Well, we
or you syndicate aggregating it. So you're basically then crawling and aggregating and use it. So it's not origination.
Yeah.
And because then you're getting into various. I noticed that you had BioBricks there, and so you're looking at an earlier one. So you're getting into a lot of technical areas.
Yep.
And to do some kind of deep dive in terms of how, what the implications of that are. So are you then having a staff or advisory board that
helps? Huge staff. So this, we are actually getting in the intelligence business, okay? When you actually start talking about tracking innovation around the globe every day and doing a substantial job at it, it's incredibly complicated. There's so many news sources, and those are just the news sources. Those aren't the universities. Those aren't the actual individuals working on this stuff. Think about going into a country like China and trying to track innovation without a transparent country. You know, I mean, this is the problem the CIA has, right? This is a problem our intelligence agencies have. We have the same problem. We are trying to track all the innovations that are taking on so we can identify what projects we should get behind, right? That's part of also our internal, you know, brainstorming of what should we get behind is based also on what we're seeing, you know, as the most exciting projects out there that are being developed. So we're at our Catalyst Center, our event facility and command center, we're building out an intelligence gathering lab that will be fully staffed with about 40 people. And it will be tracking the globe, basically. And we're developing our own systems to track everything from, you know, existing news sources with RSS feeds. I'm sure all of you guys know what an RSS reader is. To as well have human, you know, connections around the globe that we check in with every week, as well as tracking, you know, global economics and financial markets, geopolitics, all of that. Because just as we're tracking innovations that we want to get behind, we're also needing to track the marketplace to identify what's the right time to jump in and take advantage of an existing opportunity. I mean, at the end of the day, chaos is our friend. And chaos is the one constant of the worldwide market. And so if you can track it and analyze, oh, there's some kind of chaos going on here, that could be an opportunity for us to jump in and change the direction of a particular market, like biodegradable cell phones, that's what we need to do. And then we need to send in a SWAT team, you know, based on their skills and their talents. We need to launch a project. We need to engage the public all in real time. This is basically how the military operates. The difference is that because of all these new technologies, communication technologies, et cetera, we are for the first time able to take the nonprofit space into this kind of sophistication. Now, one thing you did bring up, which where does Hollywood come in? If we were just an internet startup in Silicon Valley, this would be ludicrous, probably. Because at the end of the day, you need such resources to support this thing that we're able to do it because of our Hollywood base, because we've got an organization that's highly successful in Hollywood that's been around for 2 years that can actually give this thing enough resources and power to get off the ground, because you need tremendous venture funding. You can't just launch this with no employees, obviously. You know, I mean, it would be creating havoc without any ability just to do the project submissions. And so that we're in a unique situation to launch something crazy like this, yeah.
Just sort of a couple of logistical questions.
I think we have time for two quick questions, and then we're done, yeah.
What do you get for the game?
What do you get? Saving lives isn't enough, I guess.
well,
you guys just don't like saving lives, do you?
No,
I guess because you already do it every day.
For your points over here
yeah.
on the left.
Right, so we're developing prizes that you'll get when you get up to like level 7 and you've got 7,000 points and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Spielberg.
Now, one of the ideas... Yeah, you get a meeting with Spielberg, you know. Well, I mean, to be honest, it's like...
Or is it access?
That's lovely.
Access, right? It all... Everything is connected. Everything helps everything. And in our world, the ability to leverage your existing assets and constantly, you know, refresh them is what we're able to do. We've got Hollywood. So if we did this film, for instance, we could invite you to the premiere.
Yeah.
You know? You could end up in the credits for the film, right? For instance, the Film Review Advisory Committee that's being assembled right now has the head of HBO as the chairman, head of HBO's documentary division, which is basically the most prominent documentary division in Hollywood. So it's going to have the highest level, obviously, of people involved in, you know, packaging how these films are made and everything. And I could go on and on and on as far as structures and everything. But there will be prizes. You might get an iPod. Who knows? You know.
The launching a new project every day,
yeah.
Is that logistically feasible?
It's our goal. We're not going to be doing it from day one.
Okay.
You know, like, I'd like to do 50 documentaries a year. And when I'm talking about documentaries, I'm talking about documentaries that actually make an impact, not like, you know, an inconvenient truth that doesn't have any action items on the end of it, right?
No, they told me to change my light bulbs at the end of the movie.
But what, are we going to do 50 from day one? No. Like, so, you know, we'd have to do 10 would be aggressive for the first year. We're going to scale up, basically. Yeah, Charles.
Who owns the stock? I'm still interested.
Who owns
in the
stock?
The for profit.
Sell the stock.
The for profit.
Would you like to be on the board? Because I can put you on the board of a corporation without giving you any control, and I'd be happy to.
Can his avatar be on the board?
This is a for profit corporation.
Yeah.
And
so
yes, you may have the current owner.
You know what the trickiest thing?
I
mean,
money,
he's getting at a good point, and it's a very, very important point. And I neglected to mention it. All of the entities, the hardest thing we've had to deal with, and we figured out, it's not creating all these entities. It's how do you keep the boards structured in such a way that the basically the same people are on them, that you don't lose control of them, right? Because the worst thing we have to deal with is, like, who do we let on the board? And as a general nonprofit, you have to make that decision. Who are you going to trust to go along with what you want to do and not fire you, basically, at some point, particularly in a crazy environment like this where a lot of different things can happen. We have the same three founders making up every board. Now, with a corporation, that's not a problem because, you know, you don't have as many problems. With nonprofits, they're much more restrictive with regards to how many board members you have, how transparent and independent it is, et cetera. But the conflicts of interest that could arise, should all these entities have relations with each other, is where it gets into really sticky territory. And that's what I can't go into today. But it's something that when you're looking at creating a hybrid thing like this, it gets down to that, which is like, you know, if you're going to have the same people sit on all the boards and be in control of all entities, and then you start partnering with each other, well, what are you doing with a for-profit partnering with a non-profit? All the board members are the same. Is there a major conflict of interest? Naturally, there would. This is where, structuring those things in innovative ways is what needs to be done.
Can you be sold? Can someone acquire you?
Technically, yes. We could sell Armchair Revolutionary. Would we ever, including to Google? Absolutely not. What we're going to do is our corporate mission statement, our charter, will be written and fleshed out in such a way that it will identify the values of the corporation and what we will and will not do, and that will determine. Yeah, exactly. So that if it were to have like $1 million that came in through this ad revenue at the top, for instance, like there will be a line that says, you know, no director, you know, or employee can take that in the amount, you know, in the name of salary or whatever, you know, cannot be taken out of the corporation for usage, termed as XXY. So there'll be basically a published charter that will define all the ins and outs. Yeah.
It's just you may have answered this question, but what's the financial model for supporting all of the staffing and all
yeah.
the rest of that?
Well, it's very exciting because Hollywood Hill basically has no expenses. And so we're going to have a tremendous amount of staff that for certain of these things in the beginning will be paid for through the Hollywood Hill because it has a lot of money, but it doesn't have to pay for its event facility because it has corporate sponsorship for that. We have an annual sponsorship with Wired Magazine as one of our biggest sponsors.
Okay.
So we do a lot of events.
A lot of
so it's a cash cow, essentially, right?
Wow.
So we pay for a lot of the salaries as this thing gets up and running. My salary will always be paid through the Hollywood Hill, so we don't have to take the cash out of this. But the beautiful thing about 99 cents is that all of it, 100%, goes to the project. None of it's skimmed off. And that sponsorship or whatever will pay for the operating expenses.
Okay, but you're dependent on that those sponsorships keeping on.
We are not. I wouldn't say we're dependent on it, but that's the model we're going to try out first.
Okay.
I share your skepticism. It may or may not work.
It may or may not work. In spite of, I think this is great. I'm a lot more skeptical than some of these. I think people will join. You know, why do people spend hours on Facebook? You know, they'll do it just because it's fun. You know,
exactly.
I'm not worried about that.
Yeah.
So with that ringing endorsement, I think we should bring this to a close so everyone can stick around and talk with Ariel and pepper him and give him more advice. But please join me in thanking Ariel for this provocative.
Thank you all for coming. It was great to get a chance to get in front of you. And like I said, we're launching this stuff in a matter of weeks. We'd love to have all of you involved in some capacity. And we will be hiring, etc.
There's your poison pill.
You just didn't want to take it now.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the, we're doing this called Low Lab, which actually has a lot of the ideas that you're talking.